Sorry to make you have to turn around to look at me, but it turns out the controls are better from back here, and it's all going to be in the dark anyway, and, you know, otherwise you'd have to look at me all through the whole show, and that would be cruel and unusual punishment. Before I get started, I'd like to mention that we've got some handouts there in the center of the room. As Mr. Jones so well expressed it, I am a teacher and media commentator and anything else that they will pay me for on space. And I give a lot of free, well, most of them are free, public lectures, and you are very cordially invited. There are a whole series of them going on right now in Michigan, and those are listed in the white mimeograph schedule, which is on my right up there. And there are going to be even more in the fall and winter. And the same schedule will tell you how to send off a stamped self-addressed envelope to make sure that you're on the mailing list for those. And of course, if there is anyone who is a representative of an organization that would like to have me come and speak, I would be more than happy to do it if you cross my palm with silver. In particular, I will be giving a lecture on the first results from Saturn. Tonight you're going to get Jupiter as moon, and that's going to be exciting enough. But the first spacecraft of Saturn, Pioneer 11, will get there on September 1st. I will be back in California at NASA Ames Research Center for that by then, and I'll be getting all the information for you and lots of what should be spectacular pictures. And Ritter Observatory is sponsoring me in a public lecture on Thursday, October 18th. And that will be, what, Nancy, here or not decided yet? Across the street in the Continuing Education Center, and it will be free and worth at least twice that much. And so I want you all to come and bring all your friends and double our audience, and that way maybe they'll invite me back for even more. Who knows? So tonight's lecture is the first result from the Voyager 1 encounter with Jupiter and its moons. And encounter dates were March 5th for Jupiter itself and for most of the moons, and for March 6th in the case of Callisto, the outermost. Voyager is a two-spacecraft program which has just gotten started. There is much, much more to come. The two launches were in 1977. Voyager 2 was launched first, just to make sure you get totally confused, and that was on August 20th, by coincidence, 2 years to the day after the first Viking launch to Mars. And then on Labor Day of 1977, Voyager 1 was launched. The reason for the numbering system is that they pass each other on the way to the planet. Voyager 1 was the fastest spacecraft ever to leave the Earth. Voyager 2 was only the second fastest, and it was 156 miles an hour slower. And so on about December 15th, they were at the same distance from the Earth, and ever since then, Voyager 2 has been in front. It arrives at Jupiter 4 months earlier than Voyager 1 has been in front. It arrives at Jupiter 4 months earlier than Voyager 2, and by the time they get to Saturn next year, which they both will, next year or the year after, the lead will have widened to 9 months. If all goes well, Voyager 2 will be sent on from Saturn to Uranus and perhaps even Neptune. And the dates of arrival there would be January 1986 rather for Uranus and September of 1989 for Neptune. Even if we do not take the Uranus and Neptune options, and they are not part of the official program, they're simply something we can do as a bonus if all goes well, in the same way as we're sending Pioneer 11 to Saturn after its successful flight past Jupiter 5 years ago. It was not supposed to go to Saturn, it wasn't designed to go to Saturn, but they had the capability, and if the spacecraft worked better than it was ever supposed to, it would get there, it has, it will, and that's an example of an extended mission. But if that spacecraft were to blow up tomorrow, it would still be a 100% successful mission. Likewise, don't consider it a failure if Voyager 2 cannot go on to Uranus. What's happening is that we are in the midst of an opportunity which happens only once every 175 years, called the Grand Tour Alignment of the Outer Planets. Alignment, actually configuration would be a better term. The planets in the outer solar system are not going to line up. In fact, that is mathematically impossible because of the relationships among their orbital periods. I'm getting sick and tired of hearing that they're going to line up in 1982, and it's going to cause earthquakes and all this other garbage. They aren't, it isn't. There will be many earthquakes in 1982 because there are every year, most of which are never reported because they happen in distant places that nobody except geologists cares about. In 1982, of course, the news media will report all of the earthquakes, and millions of people will go to their graves convinced that, in fact, the predicted phenomenon had happened and that it was the lineup of the planets, which in fact never happened, a fact that will not be reported, that made it happen, and you heard it first here, I offer that as a prediction. But although they are not going to line up in 1982, and California is not going to collide into the ocean, and so forth and so on, if you're going to go for this sort of thing, why not go the whole hog? A friend of mine says everything east of the San Andreas Fault is going to slide into the Atlantic. Now that's originality! You know, if you're going to do pseudoscience, do it right. But in any case, you do have a configuration of the five outer planets. such that a single spacecraft launched from Earth can fly past Jupiter in such a way that Jupiter's gravity will speed it up and deflect its path by exactly the right amount to send it on to Saturn. And Saturn will be in the right point in its orbit when the spacecraft gets there, and you can fly it past Saturn in such a way that Saturn's gravity will send it on exactly the same way to Uranus, and Uranus, when it gets there, will be in exactly the right position to do the same thing for Neptune, and Neptune, so help me, can send it on to Pluto. A chance like that happens only once every century and three quarters. In other words, the last grand tour opportunity was when Thomas Jefferson was president of the United States, and the next one will be in the middle of the 22nd century. In 1972, President Nixon, remember him? President Nixon, among the many other wonderful things he did for the country, killed the grand tour in order to save about one-third as much money as we have spent on chewing gum in the period since. Voyager is an attempt to salvage as much as possible of the grand tour opportunity. It's a good deal less expensive. It is $320 million spread over 10 fiscal years, which is less than 1/20th of what we're spending on chewing gum during the same period. This is known as cost effectiveness in the trade. What we lost was Uranus and Neptune as being part of the primary mission, and any hope for Pluto as even a secondary mission. Even so, these are spacecraft that are not just going to Jupiter and Saturn, important though that would be. They are also flying past a number of their moons, and please note when I say moon, your mind mustn't fill in minor uninterested. Many of these moons in the outer solar system are full-sized worlds in themselves. Four of Jupiter's and one of Saturn's are bigger than the planet Pluto. Two of Jupiter's and the same one of Saturn's are bigger than Mercury. And they are not only big worlds, they are so radically alien by the standards of the inner solar system bodies that we have been looking at so far as to make the Earth and Mars and Jupiter, Earth and Mars and Venus and the Moon look like twin sisters. That most of them are not even made of the same substances. If you go out on the street and ask 100 people, what do you expect a planet or a moon to be made of? I'm sure 95% of them will say, huh? But once you correct for that factor, 95% of them at least will say rock. That is inner solar system chauvinism. As a matter of fact, rock is the exception, not the rule. I'll go into this in a little bit more detail later. The majority of the planetary bodies in the universe are probably not made of rock, and therefore, to learn what normal planets are like, bizarre those these are going to seem to you when I present the results, these are the normal bodies. It is the Earth that is the exception. And the only way, of course, we can learn them is by going out there and studying them close up. So even without the Uranus and Neptune option, Voyager 1 and 2 together is a mission to at least 15 separate worlds, moons and planets. That is twice as many as in all of solar system exploration to date. Most of these are literally unknown bodies before the spacecraft gets to them. They are simply dots of light in our best telescopes. You are seeing one after another throughout the Voyager period the incredible spectacle of entire worlds suddenly becoming known in the space of a few hours each. I had the absolutely unprecedented opportunity, together with the other scientists and reporters who were there for the Voyager 1 Jupiter encounter, of being one of the first few hundred people in history to behold the face of a new world five times in a week. That is something that has never happened before in all of history, and you will be seeing it even more spectacularly than that when, for example, Voyager 1 gets to Saturn next year, when you have even more moons. So, I'm going to try to squeeze into 2 hours as much as I can everything that came out of these studies of six separate worlds, the five new ones, the moons, plus Jupiter itself, which had been studied before 5 years earlier by Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11, but in much less detail. Obviously, I'm going to have to leave out a lot. If you would like more detail, I will be giving, and it's all there in that lecture schedule, next week on Thursday in Rochester, Michigan, at Oakland University, a lecture which is longer than this one, longer than these two parts put together. It'll be 3 hours long on just the moons of Jupiter, and then the next night in Ann Arbor, I will give a 3-hour program, or almost 3 hours, on Jupiter itself. So if this turns you on, and you don't mind sitting through all the stuff you've already heard here, again, in order to get the new material, which would be about 50%, you are very cordially invited to those lectures. Both of them are absolutely free and worth at least twice that much. So, if we can have the lights out now, and I'm saying that under the sincere hope that I'm not supposed to do it myself. Oh, I'm supposed to do it myself, but that's how you do it. Okay, and the slide on. There is a picture. Is there any way of getting rid of the blue lights as well? That's the one on the right. Okay, fantastic. I want one of these for Christmas. There it is, Jupiter, the king, photographed from Earth, one of the very finest photographs ever taken. And to give you an idea of the scale of this thing, there is the moon Io, and there is its shadow on Jupiter. And the shadow is actually easier to see than Io itself in this picture. This picture was taken at the Lunar Planetary Laboratory of the University of Arizona. And that shadow is just about the diameter of the United States from one edge to the other. If the Earth were in this picture, well, the great red spot is 2.5 times the diameter of the Earth, so the Earth would be a circle about like so. I'm sure everybody in this audience is aware that Jupiter is the largest planet. You know, every astronomy textbook will tell you that. But what you may not have a full feeling for is that it's not just the largest planet. It is 2/3 of the solar system. Jupiter all by itself is heavier than all the other planets, moons, asteroids, comets, meteoroids, and debris put together. So you are seeing most of the solar system in that one picture. And in fact, of what's left over after Jupiter, more than half is Saturn. And of what's left over after Saturn, almost all is about evenly split between Uranus and Neptune. When you get to the Earth, you are dealing with something like 1/3 of 1% of the total amount of solar system matter outside the sun. And so you can see that the Earth is simply a minor piece of debris and not worth talking about it. Jupiter also is a radically different kind of body from the Earth. It has no solid surface whatsoever. Everything that you're seeing there is clouds. At least the white ones are made of frozen ammonia at a temperature of 200 below zero Fahrenheit. The dark ones may be made of frozen ammonia colored by some unknown or impurity. They are known to be lower in the atmosphere than the white ones. And we see those in places where there are holes in between the white ones. And these holes are, and the holes are always the same latitude. The white ones are always the same latitude. There are two things that we have to explain about Jupiter. One is the dramatic variability, which you will see very, very well shown in the movies that I'm going to show you. But the other one is how many things remain the same. There's only been one case in all of the history of more or less continuous observation of Jupiter with more or less adequate telescopes from Earth, where one of these white or dark stripes, the white stripes are called zones and the dark stripes are called bands, and I never can remember which is which without a lot of prompting, and so I'm not going to make you do it either, but they do have those technical terms. And each one of them, in fact, has a name because they're so permanent. There's only been one case where a permanent change in the existence of one of them has occurred, and that was at the very end of the 1930s. There used to be a bright stripe down there. It even had a name. It was called the South Temperate Zone. And at the end of the 1930s, it developed 3 pinches in it, about evenly spaced around the planet, so that for a while there, it looked sort of like a string of sausages that was going completely around the planet at that latitude. The pinches were given very clever names. They were called A, B, and C. And then the white stripe did a very strange thing. It broke off at each of the pinches, and the material between the pinches contracted in longitude, first rapidly and then more and more slowly, and still doing it more and more slowly, seems to be an exponential decline, so that there are now, instead of a complete stripe going around the planet, only 3 white oval features, which are called the long-lived ovals, and they first came into existence in more or less their present form in the early 1940s, and they're still around. And they are called, after the pinches that were at their end, AB, BC, and CA. You will see one of them very, very clearly in Voyager 1 pictures in a minute. Jupiter is very cold on the outside where you're seeing those clouds at 200 below zero Fahrenheit, but on the inside it is enormously hot. And that was discovered by radio astronomy observations from Earth about 15 years ago. We didn't know the reason for it, however, until Pioneer 10 got there and was able to make, by gravitational measurements, observations that implied the density of each layer inside Jupiter and therefore its temperature. And Jupiter, in fact, is somewhat larger, about 10% bigger, as a result of being so hot inside than it would be if it were completely cold. That's nothing like compared to a star, which is hundreds, even thousands of times bigger when it is shining, when it's still hot inside, than it is when it finally dies and goes out and becomes a cold cinder. But nevertheless, Jupiter is significantly warm on the inside. On the outside there, as I say, the temperature is 200 below zero, but if you could get just a few thousand miles below the clouds, a distance so tiny I can't even show it to you on this picture, already the temperature would be several thousand degrees, hot enough to melt any substance known. And if you could get to the center of Jupiter, if you could burrow in through 43,000 miles of this material, which is quite low in density on the outside, but gets very, very dense by the time you get to the center, you would find the temperature at the center of Jupiter is 6 times as hot as the surface of the sun, 54,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, I said 6 times wide is the surface of the sun. It is like the sun in that Jupiter is made almost entirely of hydrogen and helium. But after that, the main constituent is not rock yet. It's water. After that, methane. After that, ammonia. And then you have other things, perhaps hydrogen sulfide, neon, and so forth. And then finally, you get down to rocky material. And all the rocky material in Jupiter together is so tiny that it probably outweighs the Earth by only 2 or 3 times. Whereas if Jupiter itself outweighs, the whole of Jupiter outweighs the Earth 318 times. So Jupiter is like the Sun superficially in two respects. One, it's mostly hydrogen and helium, and the other that it is warm on the inside. But there the similarity ceases. Jupiter is almost entirely liquid. It's a big ball of fluid. It's gaseous on the outside where the material is not terribly compressed. And then as you go down further and further, it gets denser and denser and denser until you've reached a point where you might as well call it a liquid. But there is no clear-cut transition between gas and liquid. There's no place where you can say, here the gas stops and here the liquid starts, in the way you can if you go from the atmosphere of the Earth down into the ocean of the Earth, and there's no question where the interface is. Here it's all the same stuff. It's simply getting denser and denser. A star, on the other hand, is gaseous throughout. It is very, very much heavier than Jupiter. I told you that if Jupiter were hollow, you could drop in 1,000 Earths. But if the Sun, which is just an average-sized star, were hollow, you could drop in 1,000 Jupiters. And so a star or something is very, very much larger and heavier than even the biggest of the planets. And a lot of astronomy popularizers who have been impressed by the Pioneer 10 and 11 discovery that Jupiter is entirely liquid, it is mostly hydrogen and helium, have tried to express that in a very, very bad way. They said that Jupiter is really more like a star than a planet. It is not. The differences between Jupiter and a star are at least as great as the difference between the Earth and Jupiter or the Earth and a star. What you simply have to say is that there are 3 totally different kinds of body in the solar system. There is the Sun, which is a star. There are 4 Jovian planets, which are like Jupiter, mostly hydrogen, helium, and hydrogen compounds. And those are Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And then there are terrestrial planets, which are the small bodies that are so tiny that their gravity was able to hold only the solid material in their part of the solar nebula, the cloud of gas and dust from which the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago. And so they are not made of the normal cosmic composition, the way Jupiter and the Sun are. But Jupiter is not a star. A star, by definition, is something that is producing its own energy inside itself by thermonuclear reaction. Jupiter is simply warm, according to the Pioneer 10 and 11 interpretation, because when all of this enormous amount of material, 318 times as heavy as the Earth, fell together gravitationally 4.5 billion years ago, it heated itself up by the friction of all that falling together to temperatures of probably several 100,000 degrees, and that had important effects on the moons, as you will see. And then, in all of that time, it still has not totally cooled off. It is still not shining, but it's still producing heat from inside itself. Not light, and that's the definition of a star, but heat from inside itself. It emits into space 2.5 times as much heat as it receives from the Sun, and it is getting that simply by virtue of the fact that in all of these billions of years, it has not had a chance to cool off completely. But it is not generating energy by thermonuclear reaction, and it is not producing its own light, and that is the difference between Jupiter and a star. So, you confront some of these people that say Jupiter's a star, with this kind of thing, and they say, oh, well, yeah, see, we oversimplified it a little. What we were really trying to say was that Jupiter would have been a star if it had been heavier. Well, yes, that's true. If Jupiter had been 60 times as heavy as it is, it would have been a star. I looked at the numbers. If I were 60 times as heavier, I would have been an elephant. I don't think that makes me almost as heavy as an elephant. And likewise, I don't think it makes Jupiter almost as heavy as a star. It's really a completely different kind of body. But the fact that this heat is coming from inside the planet means that the simplest facts of everyday meteorology on Earth are not true on Jupiter. It is that radically different. For example, it is no colder at night than it is in the daytime. It's no colder at the poles than it is at the equator. In fact, it's hotter because you can see Jupiter is compressed. It's flattened at the equator. It bulges at the equator as a result of its rotation, as you'll see. And the result is that the poles are closer to the heat source, closer to the interior, than is the equator. And Jupiter, in fact, is so flattened by its own rotation that it's almost an entire Earth's diameter thinner through the poles than it is through the equator. And there are no seasonal changes and so forth and so on. This is a radically different kind of weather systems that we are observing on Jupiter, a very different kind of meteorology. We want to study it, therefore, in order to learn something about the variety of which nature is capable when it devises meteorologies, and thereby get a deeper understanding of how weather on all planets operates, including our own. Now, this much that I said so far, we knew about Jupiter before Voyager 1. This, as I say, is one of the very finest Earth-based Jupiter pictures that have ever been taken. Here is a picture made by the Voyager 1 spacecraft from over 1 month away from the planet. And already it looks like this. I think you can see it's pretty staggering, and, you know, day after day, the reporters at JPL just stood around thinking no pictures could possibly top these, and then the next batch of pictures did. What you can see here is, again, the white cloud stripes and the dark ones. You see more color than you saw in that Earth-based photograph because you've got better resolution now, better fineness and detail that is visible, and so things that blurred together and therefore look more pastel from Earth than they really are now seen in their true colors. There is the great red spot again. I'll have more to say about that later. And here is one of the long-lived ovals. That particular one is BC. So if any of you know Johnny Hart, you might refer him to these pictures. He might be interested. There are a number of other features visible that I want to point out particularly. You have an oval up there in the northern hemisphere at about the same latitude. And notice how you tend to have somewhat similar sorts of features at somewhat similar latitudes. And that is not by coincidence. You've got these dark spots, each of which is shown in the Voyager 1 pictures to have a bright center in the northern hemisphere right along this latitude. As you will see in the movie, there is a strong jet which extends through here, and so the spots are moving at a very different speed from the surrounding clouds, the stripes that are on either side of them. Those spots, or at least some of them, may be holes through which we are seeing further into Jupiter's atmosphere, through which we're seeing down to a lower level than you're seeing most other places on the planet. And the reason I say that is that as observed in thermal infrared from Earth, they are hotter than any place else on the planet. The great red spot, on the other hand, as observed by the infrared radiometer on the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft, was the highest place of all the clouds, about 5 miles higher than the average of the clouds around it, because it is the coldest region on the planet. So, this is what Jupiter looks like from a month out. Here is a picture taken from Pioneer 10, 6 years earlier, and you can see a number of differences that had happened in those 6 years. This picture was taken, of course, from a great deal closer, but the Pioneer cameras are not nearly as good as those on the Voyagers, and so it shows a resolution that's actually a little bit inferior. You will notice that the great red spot appears rather simple. It doesn't have all that complex structure. I'll go back to the Voyager picture in a minute. You'll be able to compare directly. It doesn't have all the complex structure around as you saw in the Voyager pictures. And the bright stripe that it's located in its particular latitude belt is quite wide and quite uniform. Whereas if you go up to the corresponding latitude belt in the northern hemisphere, the great red spot being in the southern, I'm mentioning some things that are obvious to the audience here because we're being taped for WGTE, and that is radio. So they aren't going to be able to see these slides, and I've got to give enough verbal description for the listeners to follow along. Up there in the northern hemisphere, the equivalent cloud belt is narrow, and it has a fair amount of complex structure. Now let's go back to that Voyager 1 picture, and you will see that the Great Red Spot has much more complex structure in it and around it. The cloud belt that it's in, the bright stripe that it's in, is much less bright than it had been 6 years earlier, whereas in the northern hemisphere, you have the kind of bright stripe that 6 years ago, and uniform stripe and wide stripe, that 6 years ago you had the same place in the southern hemisphere. In the southern hemisphere now for Voyager 1, you have a narrow, relatively dark for a bright stripe, and highly textured stripe. In short, it looks as though the two of them have simply changed positions. Now, of course, they haven't, but it's happened, that for whatever reasons drive Jupiter's weather, that each one has decided to switch to the appearance of the other type in about the same time period. We've seen this kind of change happen on Jupiter before many times, and we know, in fact, since Jupiter is monitored more or less continuously from the Earth, that particular change happened rather suddenly about a year after the Pioneer flyby. Up until that time, Jupiter had looked pretty much like this Pioneer view. Since that time, it has looked pretty much like this Voyager view. The great red spot is getting fainter, and as you will see more clearly in a later Voyager picture, it may be being covered over. There have been times in the past when the great red spot has disappeared, it seems, from Earth. It always reappears again. It's possible what happens is you get an even higher film of clouds, which comes over it and covers it up. There is a picture of the great red spot, one of the very closest made by either of the Pioneers. This was taken by Pioneer 11. And as you can see, even at this detail, it is rather featureless, but you can see the spiral structure, which led to the interpretation of what the great red spot is. There have been, of course, many theories over the centuries. It's been observed pretty much continuously for 300 years, and we have no idea how much further than that it goes back. It may go back millions of years or even further. We haven't had telescopes except in the last 300 years. And people have wondered what it was, but now we think we know it is a giant super hurricane that is 2.5 times the diameter of the entire Earth, has winds of 200 miles an hour and more, and has been raging in Jupiter's atmosphere for at least 3 centuries. Here is what it looked like at the time of Pioneer 11. In this slide, we see what it looks like from Voyager 1. Now, I think you can see, first of all, it's a spectacular picture, and I've got one coming up to make even this one look sick. But also, you can see there's a lot of difference, which is not simply the slightly better resolution, slightly better fineness of detail visible that you have in this picture as compared to what you had from Pioneers 10 and 11. There is a lot of real difference. The spiral structure is not as obvious because of this invading cloud, which is the slightly brighter stuff here, and you have a good deal more complex structure in and around the red spot. You have areas of extreme turbulence downstream of it. And you will see the motion in the movie that I will show you, and it's very, very complex in this region downstream. And you also have a region that's developed down here at the bottom edge of the southern edge of the now fairly narrow bright stripe the Great Red Spot was in, where there is also a great deal of turbulence. The cloud circulation in the Great Red Spot, and it turns out, this is the Voyager 1 discovery, in the other spots as well. For example, BC is the same sort of thing. It's a giant hurricane. And all these ovals are the same sorts of things. They're giant spinning systems of wind carrying cloud with it. But they have a circulation, a wind pattern, that is in the anti-cyclonic direction, which in the southern hemisphere of a planet that, like Earth or Jupiter, rotates from west to east, means that it is in a counterclockwise direction. Anticyclonic is what you get on Earth in a high-pressure system. We don't know whether this means that these are not storms in one crucial respect, namely that the circulation here is anticyclonic, in other words, that these are high-pressure systems instead of low-pressure systems, as hurricanes and other storms on Earth are, or whether it's related to the fact that, believe it or not, in hurricanes on Earth, at the very top level, and those, of course, are all you see in the space photograph, the circulation is actually anticyclonic. Even though further down, for almost the whole body of the storm all the way down to the surface, the circulation is cyclonic, as you expect from a low-pressure system. We cannot see anything but the top of the Great Red Spot here, and so we can't answer that question for you at this point. Let's zoom in on the Great Red Spot and see how the detail became better and better day after day. This is a picture that shows in magnificent detail the long-lived oval BC with the spiral circulation very clearly visible in it, and most of the Great Red Spot up there. And here is a picture actually taken at the same time. That other picture I just showed you is this area here, which shows the unbelievable complexity, the detail and the structure of this turbulence that you get both south of and north of the Great Red Spot downstream of it. Most of the turbulence shows circulation in the cyclonic direction. In other words, the turbulence, of course, is not nearly as organized. It's not that nice, a nice simple elliptical rotation the way you get on the spot. But when you see rotational movement, and one of the big discoveries from Voyager 1 is that there is far more rotational movement, or to put it another way, far more north-south movement, as well as the east-west movement we knew about all along, than we had ever realized. When you see this rotational movement, usually in these turbulent zones, it is in the cyclonic direction. But as you will see very clearly in the movie, in this very disturbed region that is downstream of the Great Red Spot to the north, the motion is cyclonic, not anticyclonic. Let's pause for a moment before we go any further to just consider this picture as a work of art, as an aesthetic thing. Carl Sagan said a few days after it was taken that everybody's first reaction to it is, that looks like a painting by, and they can't think who it is. You know, it looks sort of like some piece of abstract art, but Jupiter seems to have a style all of its own. And another very common reaction is that these features, especially these turbulent zones, look like colored oils on water. Tears themselves out into some sort of uniform, bland color, and that would be the end of it. So you see what I said. We have two things to explain. Number one, why there are some things that remain constant. The latitude of the great red spot never changes. It's always right there at the same latitude. The latitude of all these stripes never change. On the other hand, why there are some things that are so extremely variable. When you get down to the very, very finest scale, and believe me, Voyager 1 zoomed in on this far more than I'm showing you here. When you get down to the picture taken at the very closest encounter, then they turned out to be featureless. At the very tiniest scale, and there you are seeing things that are maybe a few tens of miles across, at the very finest scale, then the features do blur into one another just a little bit. WGTE is taping us, and they just ran out of tape, so I'm going to repeat that, that last sentence. At the very finest scale, when you get down to the pictures that were taken at the very closest encounter, that show things maybe a few tens of miles across, then you see that they blur together, the pictures appear featureless. In other words, at that scale, you have a little bit of mixing between the boundaries of these otherwise, at any higher scale, fantastically self-contained cloud features. When I say self-contained, you know, they get distorted, they get broken in half, they change their shape, they change their size, but they stubbornly refuse to merge with one another, and they act, as I say, very much like colored fluids on water. Let us at this point, no, I'm sorry, I've got one more picture, which is a black and white mosaic that shows the detail even better. The black and white pictures, you see, Voyager 1 cannot take color pictures directly. It can take three black and white pictures through colored filters, each of which isolates one third of the spectrum. And from that, you can, given the way the human eye perceives color, you can synthesize a full color picture by computer on the ground. But since they were taken at very slightly different times, very slightly different distances, directions, and so forth, there's a little bit of blurring when you try to add them together, and the very finest detail is shown in these black and white pictures. What I want to do at this point, come to think of it, what I want to do is go on a little bit. All right. This is a picture, I changed the films in the order in which I was going to show them at the very last minute here, and that's why I'm getting confused. This is a picture taken in more or less normal color. All of these color pictures that I'm showing you, unless otherwise advertised, are slightly exaggerated in color and in contrast, but only slightly. They are very nearly what you would see with the eye if you were there sitting next to the spacecraft. This next one, however, is an exception. This one is a picture that is a version of this very same picture, which was subjected to first a computer program which would remove the overall dominant red color, and then a computer program which would exaggerate the slight color differences that were left over. And so here is the great red spot after that's been done to it. This is not the way it really looks, but it's a useful picture. And I think you can see, you get the impression that this white cloud material has invaded the red spot and has flowed over the red stuff, because you can actually see some of the structure of the red cloud material through the overlying white layer. And that is even more obvious when you compare it in pictures taken several hours apart, and you can see how the motions go. Maybe then the great red spot is about to disappear, or maybe this stuff will simply invade it to a certain distance and then stop. Here is a picture of Jupiter which is taken from Earth, which I put in to remind me to tell you about the rotation. This is a full Jupiter, you don't have any shadowed part at all, and I think it shows very well the discrepancy between the polar diameter and the equatorial diameter, which is bulging as a result, I hate to say centrifugal force because it's neither centrifugal nor a force, but as a result of the planet's motion, the complex of factors that is usually miscalled centrifugal force has made it bulge. And the reason for this is that Jupiter is a very rapid rotator. Jupiter is not only the biggest planet, it also has the shortest day of any of the planets in the solar system. This entire enormous object, 1,000 times the size of the Earth, whirls around its axis once every 10 hours, which means that a point on the equator of Jupiter is moving simply by virtue of the rotation of the planet almost as fast as an Apollo spacecraft leaving the Earth to go to the moon. The equator of Jupiter moves at 22,000 miles an hour. The Apollo spacecraft left the Earth at 25,000 miles an hour. And for comparison, a point on the equator of the Earth moves at about 1,000 miles an hour. That is what causes this east-west dominance of the flows in Jupiter's atmosphere, and that is what causes the striped appearance of the planet. These stripes are features which on Earth would be high and low pressure centers. But on Jupiter, the effect of the planet's rotation, some of you know what the phrase Coriolis effect means, and it's, I haven't got time to explain it in a lecture this short, for those of you that don't, but those of you that do immediately will understand as soon as you hear the name, that the Coriolis effect of this kind of rotation is going to be very extreme, and especially in the equatorial regions, it is going to cause north-south flows that otherwise would happen to simply get twisted out into east-west flows very rapidly. Only the storms that are the very strongest, such as the Great Red Spot, and you notice there are none of them managed to do this at the equator itself where the Coriolis effect is strongest because the rotation is greatest. Only the storms of the greatest integrity are able to maintain their identity against this Coriolis tendency to tear them apart. And even then, you will notice that even those are elongated. The Great Red Spot is about 2.5 times as long as it is wide. When you look at the polar pictures of Jupiter, which were taken by Pioneer 11, I haven't included any of those because this is mainly a Voyager lecture, but when you look at those, you will find that the intensity of this striped appearance gets, the dominance of it in the appearance of Jupiter gets less and less as you go from the equator toward the pole. And when you get to about the same latitude on Jupiter as Toledo is on Earth, in other words, about halfway from the pole to the equator, you find that it breaks down more or less completely, and from there on, you have a hint of stripes. Those appear in the Voyager 1 pictures. We did not see them in the Pioneer 10 and 11 pictures, but it's only a hint, and the scene is dominated by the individual storm systems. At this point, it occurred to me that probably most of you, even professional astronomers, had never really had a chance to see a planet actually rotate before your eyes. Well, you are about to have that opportunity. February of this year, Voyager 1, which was about 20 million miles away from the planet at the time, took a series of pictures every 5 minutes. They took the three pictures necessary to synthesize a color image, and they kept that up for 20 hours, two entire Jupiter rotations. Those have been put together as a time-lapse movie, which is presented at a speed such that 1 second in the movie equals 1 hour in the original. And you will see two Jupiter days go by, and toward the end, you will see two of the moons, first Europa and then Io, come in from the lower left, and then you will see their shadow. You'll see them move across in front of Jupiter and disappear out of the edge of the frame, and then you will see their shadows move across the face of Jupiter. So, if I can figure out which one of these things turns down the slides, I thought I had it. I swear that's the one I turn them up with. Oh, it's this one! All right. And here is the Voyager 1 rotation film. There comes Europa. Now Io. Notice that Io is moving faster and it's red. And there's the shadow of Europa, and there's the shadow of Io. Tell you what, why don't we go right ahead with the other film. Let me explain for a moment what it is. This is another kind of movie in which the rotation has been artificially stopped. What they did was, for over a month, in January and February of this year, take the three images necessary for a color picture of Jupiter, every time the same face of Jupiter was turned toward the camera, and that face was chosen to be the one with the Great Red Spot center, just the way you're seeing it in this Earth face picture. So the effect, and then they played them back together as a movie, and so the effect is that you are seeing the 200-mile-an-hour winds blowing features the size of the Earth around on Jupiter's cloud surface for a period of over an Earth month. It is speeded up a great deal. There are two different versions in the film. One is a little bit slower than the other, and I find the faster one actually gets the idea across better. So what we're going to do is go through the slow one, and then go through the fast one, and there's so much going on that there's no way you're going to be able to take it all in with one viewing. So when we get to the end of the fast one, we're going to stop it. We're going to run it backwards so that you can watch everything unwind and see how the final appearance develops, and then we're going to run it forward again. We're going to do that several times. So let's run that portion of the movie now. Thank you. Little features to notice, a very strong jet in the equatorial region, which is causing features to appear here, and it's hard to see this pointer, and plume out, trail out behind as they move. Notice the counterclockwise circulation around the Great Red Spot, the motion of the long-lived oval BC, which is going faster than the Great Red Spot is. It's overtaking the Great Red Spot. Up in the northern hemisphere, the motion of those hot spots, the dark oval. Now, here comes the fast version. It'll be much more obvious. You really see what is meant by the term weather machine. Let's run that back now. Can we run that back? Yeah. And now forward. Watch this little feature here, this little bright feature. Forward, please. Forward! It's not his fault. It's very hard for him to hear in that projection booth. Watch this feature move along, get sucked into the, watch it, there it goes, get sucked into the rotating current around the Great Red Spot, swirl around the Great Red Spot, get distorted, it breaks in two, part of it goes off to the east, and the other part continues off to the west in the same circulation that it was in. And yet, it insists on retaining its individuality. Why don't you do it one more time? Okay, great. Thank you very much. Now let's give WGTE a chance to get their tape turned back on again. No. No, I can see that. It's definitely a non-visual medium. And I tell you, I had a real problem with that reporting it for radio. Here I was, two national networks wanting to know what they saw. And it was, as you see, no words will do it any justice. Okay, let's wrap up Jupiter with some of the more unexpected Voyager 1 discoveries. This is the lightning picture and requires a bit of explanation. When the spacecraft was in the shadow of Jupiter, in other words, in sun occultation, behind the planet as seen from the sun, they had to take a series of pictures, and these are long time exposures. Each one of these is about 3.5 minutes long, and this is the most spectacular one. You can see that the picture is very noisy. There's a lot of snow on it, just like the snow on your television, and it's there for a somewhat similar reason. Jupiter is surrounded by extremely intense radiation belts, like the Van Allen belts that ring the Earth and are trapped by the Earth's magnetic field. These are subatomic particles, mostly protons and electrons, that are trapped by the Earth's magnetic field and constitute a danger if you fly through them. It's not a danger that can't be overcome, but it is a danger. In the case of Jupiter, the belts are as much as a million times as intense as those that ring the Earth, depending on which energy level you're talking about. And if you had ridden along on Voyager 1, you would have experienced a radiation dosage about 1,000 times the amount necessary to kill an unprotected human. The pioneers went even closer. They didn't take as good pictures because the cameras weren't as good, but pioneers 10 and 11 both exceeded 2,000 times the lethal radiation dose for people. The effects of the radiation on the spacecraft are not negligible. They're not enough to destroy it entirely, although they do have a tendency to knock out instruments. One thing that they did, especially with the Pioneers, which had much, much dumber computers than the Voyagers, was this is, after all, an electric current moving through the spacecraft. These are charged particles that are moving through the spacecraft. And so they would do things which the computer would interpret as commands from Earth. And it would do things like turn off the cameras at the moment of closest approach. And that danger had been foreseen. And so throughout the Pioneer encounters, for every 10 minutes, around the clock, for 48 hours before and after the time of closest approach, a series of commands was sent up to the spacecraft. Turn on your camera. Turn on your Geiger counter. Turn on your infrared radiometer. Turn on, and so forth and so on. And the spacecraft was designed so that if the thing was on anyway, it would ignore the command, but if it was off, it would turn it back on. And so, at most, you would lose 10 minutes of data from a given instrument, usually less than that. And, in fact, the strategy worked. Well, in the case of the Voyagers, they're a little bit smarter than that, but in this long time exposure in the dark, you really do see the effects of the radiation belt. This is the edge of the planet, and you are seeing 20,000 miles worth of it there, and all of it is covered by aurora. The first aurora, Northern Lights, ever photographed on another planet. and that entire 20,000-mile or more long aurora had come into existence during the 90 seconds since the picture before this one was taken. That picture does not show any aurora at all. The other thing that you see are these bright dots on the surface, and those are lightning flashes. Again, the first ever photograph on another planet, although earlier in the year, the Russian Venera 11 and 12 landers on Venus, and then the American Pioneer Venus orbiter confirming it, discovered lightning by the radio emissions it emits, discovered it indirectly by the radio emissions it emits on Venus. And so now we know three planets in the solar system where there is lightning, the Earth, of course, being the third, and just a few months ago, we knew only the Earth. These bolts that we're seeing on Jupiter are pretty spectacular in common with everything else on that planet. There are probably many more of them going on at any given moment than this picture implies, although there are 17 individual bolts visible in this picture alone. But we're probably seeing only the places where there happen to be holes in the upper cloud layer, and we can see down to some lower layer in the atmosphere where the lightning is actually occurring. These lightning strokes are as intense as the most intense that are ever observed on Earth. But that is really misleading, because the most intense that are observed on Earth are the so-called super bolts, and they were only discovered 2 years ago in pictures from Earth satellites. You've never seen them from the ground in Ohio. The super bolts are found only at the tops of thunderstorms and then only in the tropics. So a more meaningful statement would be to say that these Jovian lightning bolts, and certainly is appropriate for Jupiter to be hurling lightning bolts, mythologically appropriate, if nothing else, these Jovian thunderbolts are 100 times as strong, as intense, as any lightning that you have ever seen from the surface of the Earth. And then, of course, there is the famous ring. This is not a photograph of the ring. There's only one picture that's been taken of it, and I'll show you that in a minute, the Discovery picture. This is a Voyager 1 picture of Jupiter taken during the approach with an ellipse that's been drawn in simply to show you where the outer edge of the ring is. We do not know at this point where the inner edge is. In fact, we know very little about the ring aside from the fact that it exists and, by an unbelievable stroke of fortune, the location of its outer edge. And even that is still being refined because they've got to refine navigation data as to exactly which way the spacecraft camera is pointing at the moment that it photographed the ring. They took the picture that discovered it. But one of the scientists at JPL put up this picture or one like it in his office the day after the ring discovery was announced, and a big caption under it, Jupiter. It has a nice ring to it. Well, it does have a nice ring to it, and a lot of commentators have remarked on the fact that now all of the four giant planets, the Jovian planets that dominate the outer solar system, are known to have rings, with the exception of Neptune, and Neptune may very well also, it's the one that is hardest to observe, because it's farthest from the Earth, and we have not yet been able to send a spacecraft to it. But to me, what is more important is that all of the rings are very, very different from one another. So different that I really wonder if it may not almost be coincidence that all three of those planets do, in fact, have rings, Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus. They may have rings, coincidentally, for completely different reasons. Saturn's rings, of course, are very different from those of Jupiter. Obviously, Jupiter doesn't have rings like Saturn's, or we'd have been seeing them through telescopes from Earth for centuries. After all, Jupiter is only half as far from us as Saturn is. The rings of Saturn are very dense, a lot of particles in them. For anybody who isn't aware of the fact, a planetary ring is not a solid body. It's not a flat sheet the way it may look in the pictures. It is millions and millions of little pieces of solid material. They're all orbiting around the planet in about the same orbit. And the pieces, in the case of Saturn's rings, are either made of or at least covered by ice, frozen water. And there are a lot of them, and so Saturn's, since ice is so reflective and there are so many of the particles, Saturn's rings are very bright. They are very reflective. They reflect a lot of sunlight and we can see them well. Saturn's rings are also pretty much continuous. That is, there is a zone of distances out from the planet in which you have ring material, some of it darker, some of it lighter, so some of it denser and some of it less dense, but ring material all the way through except for just one relatively narrow gap, the Cygnus division. The rings of Uranus, on the other hand, are made of some exceedingly dark rock. It cannot have an albedo or reflectivity of more than 2%, and so that is darker than any rock that is common on Earth. It's darker than basalt, soft coal, even obsidian. It may be carbonaceous chondritic material. For those of you who are familiar with meteorites, that is very common in the outer solar system. The moons of Mars are made of it. Recently we found out that most of the asteroids are made of it. So the rings of Uranus may be made of it also. There is no ice obvious in the rings of Uranus. And perhaps the most startling difference between Uranus's and Saturn's rings is that Uranus's rings are almost all gas. There are something like 9 of them at the latest count. And what you have is you got a ring, and then you have a narrow ring, only a few miles across, and then you have hundreds, even thousands of miles worth of gap, and then you have another narrow ring, only a few miles or a few tens of miles across, and then hundreds or thousands of miles of gap, and so forth. And in fact, there are 4 different kinds of rings around Uranus. I haven't got time to go into that any further, but there's a lot of complexity there. We don't understand it. At this point, we simply cannot, literally cannot understand how rings such as Uranus has can exist. Well, in the case of the rings of Jupiter, they are even lower in density, probably, than those of Uranus. They are so hard to see that, well, yes, they now have been photographed from Earth, but they never had been before Voyager got there, despite the fact that we now realize, by hindsight, that Pioneer 11 flew through the rings in 1974. And we didn't even know the fact that was happening at the time. Naturally, after the ring had been discovered, they looked back in the old Pioneer 11 data, and yes, indeed, the spacecraft had been hit by a micrometeorite, just one micrometeorite in one little dust grain, at the appropriate time. And furthermore, it had noticed a diminution in the strength of the radiation belt material that was hitting it, the intensity of the radiation that was being subjected to. And in fact, buried there in the literature of the Pioneer 11 report is the possible interpretation by some of the particles and fields people that what had happened was, in fact, that the radiation belt material was being absorbed by, as they put it, dust. So in a sense, Pioneer 11 discovered, or at least strongly implied, the existence of the ring 5 years ago, but of course, this is the first time we've actually had a photograph of it. Now, the photograph was taken like this. They knew that if Jupiter had a ring at all, it was going to be very, very thin, and it was going to be invisible unless you took the picture from exactly in the plane of the ring so that you were looking right through all of the particles in the entire thickness of the ring. And so they took a picture just as the spacecraft was flying over the equator of Jupiter, because the plane of the ring would have to be over the equator of the planet for reasons that I can go into if you want me to afterwards. There were so many things that had to be done by Voyager 1 at Encounter, both with Jupiter and the Moon, that it was felt that this picture had a very, very low priority, and exactly one picture was programmed to be taken, just in the off chance there might be a ring. Incredibly enough, that picture not only showed the ring, it showed the edge of the ring, so that we know the size of it, or at least where its outer edge is. And that is just one of several cases where the gods were really with us on Voyager 1, where we got just an incredible stroke of luck that really we had no reason to assume that we deserved. Here is the discovery picture of the ring, and if you're not an astronomer, if you're not really used to this sort of thing, everybody's first reaction is, where's the ring? The ring, there are 6 images of it, and each one of them looks like a straight line for reasons you saw on the last slide, and there are the 6 images. The earliest one that was taken was the one on the bottom, and the latest one, the one on the top. And those jagged images in the back are stars. They are, in fact, and the amateur astronomers will appreciate from this how very, very highly magnified these telephoto pictures of Voyager 1 are. Those are the well-known star cluster that is called Precepe, or M44, or the Beehive. And it more than fills the frame. And the reason it appears jagged is that during the course of the exposure, which is a very long exposure, about 20 minutes, during the course of the exposure, the spacecraft was wobbling very, very slightly. It's a good spacecraft. It has high pointing accuracy, but this is also a very, very highly magnified picture. And so you can see a little bit of the wobble. The reason that it wobbled was the scan platform, which is the movable portion of the spacecraft on which the cameras and the other instruments that you might want to point now in one direction, now in another, are mounted, had just been moved over to that position, and that excited vibrations in one of the booms, the long arms that stick out in all directions from the spacecraft and make it look like a spider, that hold the various instruments, the ones that have to be held away from the central spacecraft itself for various reasons. The boom, the longest one, and the one that was doing the vibrating here, is 43 feet long, and it holds the 2 magnetometers. The magnetometer boom is therefore the length, is as long as the 4-story building is high. So you can understand that a little bit of vibration in that could have this kind of effect. And the way the spacecraft would vibrate is it would move rapidly, as you see this long trail in each of the stars, then it would move hardly at all. It would just sit there. And then it would move rapidly again, and then it would just sit there. And then it would move rapidly, and it would just sit there, and so forth. The stars are all overexposed, and so you can't tell any difference in the brightness of the various portions of the trail. But in the case of the ring, which was fainter, you expose the ring every time it was in one of those six standstills. And so the fact there are six standstills correlates with the fact that there are six ring images. And then, in the rapid motion, you are exposing the ring hardly at all. Meanwhile, the spacecraft was moving in towards Jupiter, and so every time it took a new image, the ring edge was a little bit further over in the field, and that is an actual reflection of the orbital motion of the spacecraft during the 20 minutes or so that it took to expose this picture. Finally, the thickness of the ring, the vertical thickness, cannot be measured from this picture. It is below the resolution ability of the camera, and from that fact, we can tell you that it is definitely less than 20 miles. It is probably a great deal less than that on theoretical grounds. The rings of Jupiter, we don't know how similar they are to Saturn's or Uranus's as far as structure is concerned. They must be made of some very dark material. If you want to assume their carbonation is chondritic too, fine. Then you've got to explain why Saturn's are so bright and Jupiter's are made of this very much darker material. They are very low in density. We do not know at this point whether this is a ring or rings, whether there is one gap or more gaps, maybe mostly gaps the way you have in the rings of Uranus. Or whether it's a solid sheet, or whether it's a sheet with just one gap in it like Saturn, that we can't say. There is a place, a distance from a planet, which many of you know about, which is called the Roche limit, within which you expect a ring to be, and you will be happy to learn that this ring is indeed within Jupiter's Roche limit, and its innermost moon, Amalthea, is outside it. And so, at least in that respect, this is a properly behaved ring. We've got to move on. We've got to talk about the moons of Jupiter. I tell you, I'm trying to cover five entire worlds in 2 hours, and it is not easy. Here is a picture which was taken to give you another indication of how incredible those telescopic cameras are. This was taken in December from 275 million miles away in the middle of the asteroid belt. And you can see better detail. You can see through at least some telescopes that I looked at Jupiter through from Earth. There is Jupiter itself. That dot is not the great red spot. That is one of those Rizzo marks, those dots that are deliberately put on the television faceplate, which you saw in several of the other pictures, to check the geometric accuracy of the pictures. And the computer tried to erase it, and only partially succeeded. And around Jupiter, you can see the four brightest moons. These are the planet-sized ones, the Galilean satellites, so-called because they were discovered by the Italian astronomer Galileo Galilei with history's first astronomical telescope in 1609. And in fact, a very few people with very, very exceptionally good eyesight can actually see them with the naked eye. That is not normal, but a few people are able to do it. They are known technically as liars. Now, there are cases where, you know, some 12-year-old kid who didn't know anything about how Jupiter had moons reported seeing these bright stars, and he drew them and checked them out, and yes, they really were in that position. The four Galilean satellites are from closest to Jupiter to farthest out, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. And Europa looks in this picture as though it's closer than Io because it's seen along the line of sight. It's either in front of Jupiter or behind it. I'm not sure which. Note on the pronunciation Io. I've said Io all my life, and apparently that is considered an acceptable anglicization. But if you want to be more classically accurate, that means snobbish, you say Io. And so I've been trying to train myself to say Io the same way as I've trained myself to say Uranus and then Chrissy for the Viking Lander 1 site and so forth. Usually I manage to succeed. Occasionally I have slip-ups. Well, these moons are very different kinds of bodies from the, most of them anyway, are very different, well, all of them in some respects are very different kinds of bodies from the inner solar system planets. I put this picture on, which I'm sure most of this audience is going to recognize as the Orion Nebula, one of the great clouds of gas and dust in space in which stars form. In this particular case, we can see it, so star formation is finished. But most of the pictures in this, because the stars are lighted up, you see, they're lighting up the nebula around them. But most of the stars in this picture have formed in that nebula out of the gas and dust that it's made of within the last 20,000 years. And that, of course, makes them, you know, literally newborn babies by the astronomical standards where stars are more likely hundreds of millions to tens of billions of years old. Most of the universe is made of hydrogen and helium. For the very simple reasons, those are the two simplest kinds of atoms in the universe, and the processes that created our atoms concentrated mostly on those simplest kinds. There's much more to the story than that. Many of you know the story, and we haven't got time to go into it for those of you who don't. But most of the universe, 99% of the atoms that make up our universe, are hydrogen and helium. the remainder, that remaining 1% that makes up all the other kinds of matter that we learn about in the chemistry course, all the different elements, are grossly undemocratically distributed. About half of the remainder is just one kind, and that is oxygen. And then after that, you have just a few very common ones, carbon, nitrogen, sulfur, neon, that sort of thing, which are making up virtually all of the rest. As a result of this, if you wish to consider what a planet ought to have been made of, or a moon, when it formed out of the cloud of gas and dust that formed the solar system 4.5 billion years ago, and that's called the Solar Nebula, and its equivalent would have been a very, very tiny part of this great Orion Nebula that you're seeing here. In one of these big nebulae, you have star formation going on simultaneously at several hundred to several thousand places within the cloud itself. So please understand when we say solar nebula, we're not talking about anything like as big as this whole thing. You're talking about a very tiny part, so tiny that the scale, I couldn't even show it to you, the scale of this picture. If you are interested in knowing what a planet or a moon that formed out of these substances should have been made of, all you've got to worry about is the abundances of the very commonest kinds of atoms. You simply don't have to worry about praseodymium or molybdenum or platinum or lead being playing any sort of major role in the chemistry of your planet. And you find that, in fact, in addition to the star, our sun, in our solar system, there are two very different kinds of planets.